The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Lawfare Archive.
Hello, this is Lawfare intern Ajay Sarma with a podcast from the Lawfare Archives for June 27th, 2021. On Wednesday, the Russian Ministry of Defense reported that a patrol ship fired warning shots at a British warship en route to Georgia that it alleged had entered Crimean territorial waters, water that Russia claimed as its own after its 2014 annexation of Crimea. But this is just the latest sign of tensions between U.S. allies and Russia, another major nuclear power. For today's episode from the archives, I went back to July 2015 to revisit a Brookings panel discussing Russia's nuclear threats during the 2014 Crimea crisis. Lawfare listeners will be able to understand the role that aggressive deterrence plays in Moscow's foreign policy toolbox, especially when it comes to defending its claim of sovereignty over Crimea.
You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Thanks for coming to Brookings, and I know it's a very hot day, so you made it through, and we're very proud to welcome you to what we're reliably told is the second most popular event at Brookings at this moment. This event comes a little bit from some of the discussions that we've had on our blog, on the Order from Chaos blog, particularly from Pavel and from Steve, on what all of these Russian nuclear threats really that we've been hearing in the last several months really mean. You know, it's a sort of interesting feature of discussion in Washington right now that there's a tremendous amount of focus on nuclear negotiations with Iran, which are premised on the fact that it's really very important for the world to worry about the possibility that an irrational country might acquire nuclear weapons. At the same time, we're hearing threats from leaders in Moscow who already possess several thousand nuclear weapons and maybe paying a little bit less attention. So we wanted to rectify that balance a little bit in our own tiny little way. And I think we have a really excellent panel to do that here today. First on my right is Pavel Baev, who's research director at PRIO, which is the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, and also a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. So he's part of our broader family. To my left is Steve Pfeiffer, who is had every position I could name in the U.S. government and is also a senior fellow here in our Arms Control Initiative and director of our Arms Control Initiative. And on my far left is Hans Christensen, who is the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. And so what we're going to do is we're going to start with Pavel, who's going to give us, I think, a little bit of sense about what the meaning of all these Russian nuclear threats that we've been hearing in recent months are. Pavel?
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for your kind words. It's a privilege to be here, and I'm very glad about this opportunity to share with you all not that much my analysis, but more probably my worries, because what we are observing in Russian behavior as far as nuclear matters are concerned is very worrisome. And suddenly we rediscover again that nuclear matters matter because there is a lot of nuclear weapons. We know that. We know many things about nuclear capabilities. There are some things we don't know, particularly as far as non-strategic weapons are concerned. That's a big black hole in the whole problematic. But as far as knowing what constitutes the subject matter is concerned, we know quite a lot, and probably my colleagues on the panel will be able to fill you better about the known variables. And I will try to address the very difficult question of why. What's the point? Where Putin is going at, and what can we expect from that? And again, it is very speculative. I don't really have an access to his internal brain works. I don't have much of an insight in how the very tight circle of his aides and courtiers work. It is something I try to infer. And my answer on the question of why comes in two parts. And I hope to be wrong on both, by the way. On both accounts. The first part of the answer has a very simple name of color revolution. Putin is obsessed with the threat of color revolution, which comes in different kinds and shades. There were suddenly protests in the streets of Moscow when he was assuming presidency out of nothing. Quite a shocking thing. He took very carefully care of that. But again, this specter of revolution has not disappeared. It's looming somewhere here and there. It's suddenly coming up in Armenia. And Putin is saying what's happening in Armenia is certainly plotted and in Washington manipulated down to the every move from there. And that is very much how he perceives the threat of color revolution. And that is why nuclear weapons are relevant in this context. Because otherwise, if you think revolutions happen because the elites are unable to contain the public protest, nuclear weapons are irrelevant. But if your mindset is that the color revolutions are something plotted, organized, sponsored by Washington, then suddenly nuclear weapons come into play. And you push again and again the line. Do you really want a regime change in Moscow? Do you really want to play with these catastrophic scenarios of huge nuclear superpower falling apart? Yes, it has happened before. Soviet Union did fall apart. I am no Gorbachev, says Putin. I will not be sitting idly and watching how it happens. I will fight for that. And the fight can turn very ugly. And nuclear weapons will be there. Do you want really to play with this sort of scenarios? So nuclear card becomes a deterrent in his head against the threat of color revolutions projected, created, manipulated from the West, from Washington in particular. And it's very difficult to dissuade him, but at least this part of the answer doesn't really contain necessarily immediately risks of such intensity that we don't know how to deal with that. Even if it's impossible to dissuade him against that, we don't really see signs that situation in Russia suddenly goes out of control. It might. Those situations are impossible to predict. They cannot predict them in Kremlin as well. But nevertheless, it's hardly anything anybody can do about that because, revolutions are revolutions. They happen. And if somebody thinks about deterring them this way, it's just another blunder in the many annals of the failure to contain revolutions. The second part of my answer, however, is somewhat more material, let's say, because it rests on the fact that in the Russian very significant, very costly effort at modernizing the armed forces, which started a little bit before Putin's return to the position of power in the Kremlin in the year 11, essentially, from the very start of year 11. A huge program of rearmament, very costly, was presented and approved for the next 20 years. It's a rolling program, so targets are shifting. but the main timescale was 10 years. And in that program, the main priority is on modernizing strategic nuclear weapons. That sort of potential. Very costly programs were pushed forward in every component of these forces. First of all, certainly with nuclear submarines, and they are very costly, costly items. Their missiles are costly. The submarines as such are costly. And that effort was sustained, and it's still sustained. And on the context of Ukraine, you would think this investment is essentially a mistake. That priority in all your military modernization is a blunder, because that's not what you need in this situation. If you have two more strategic submarines or two less, what sort of difference it makes for this crisis? If you have 10 more battalions, that would make a difference. Nevertheless, they insist on that priority in the allocation of resources for nuclear modernization, for military modernization, probably because the programs are halfway through, and you have this half-baked product you still need to bring into some sort of fruition. And Putin is again saying, yes, we need to deploy these 40 new missiles, which creates a lot of anxiety suddenly, while he's not saying anything new. In fact, last year he promised 50 missiles, not 40. And of those missiles, kind of at least 30, 32 in my count, are Bulava missiles. Probably correct me if I am wrong on that count. He's not saying anything new, but he is saying we're insisting on that priority. And having invested all these resources, having put all this effort into this very costly system, what is the output? What is the political dividend? None. Isn't this, in this very tense situation with the West, these weapons are not really an asset. He cannot put them into play. And that creates certainly a lot of dissatisfaction. We have put all these resources, we invested all this money, and we cannot gain any profit on that. How to put that into play. He's trying this and he's trying that. There are a series of statements, certainly. There are some demonstrations. For instance, Russian strategic bombers approached United States airspace on the 4th of July saying, Happy Independence Day. But it's not, that doesn't really amount to much. The bombers are really extremely old, and they are probably make good interception targets for U.S. Fighters, but hardly really much of a threat. The main threat they constitute is that they will crash, and that's certainly very very unpleasant proposition. What else? How else can you put this investment onto play? And I will not really try to suggest an answer to that. I don't think the good answer exists. My main worry in this context is about resumption of nuclear testing. It's still something which can reasonably easily be done, and there are signs that the nuclear test site on Novaya Zemlya is becoming reactivated. There are more troop deployments there. There are kind of some construction going there. And you can do that without really a massive investment, and you are certain to create colossal political resonance. Even if a nuclear weapon could be a very small yield, you don't need another side bomb of 50 megatons. You might do something very small with no environmental damage if you are very concerned about that. Nevertheless, the resonance will be certainly huge, and at least in that you might hope to harvest some political dividends from the nuclear might you possess and cannot really utilize. And as I said, I really, really hope I am wrong on that account, and that's my 10 minutes.
Thanks, Pavel. That was sufficiently scary. Steve, I'm wondering, following up on that, if you could give us some sense of what the Russian nuclear forces actually are and what they might be useful for.
Now, well, first, I would agree with Pavel. I think the thing that worries me most about the Russian nuclear stance is you have Vladimir Putin out there talking so much about nuclear weapons in a way that I think is borderline irresponsible. But it's taking place in a context in which the Russians are doing a lot, as Pavel suggested, in terms of modernizing both their strategic and non-strategic nuclear forces. Now, some of these things are worrisome, some are not. Let me just go through the programs and describe what I think the United States needs to be concerned about. First of all, there's a lot going on in terms of the Russian Strategic Modernization Program. They're deploying a new ballistic missile submarine, the Bore class. I think three have gone to sea now out of the planned program of eight. They are equipping that with a new submarine-launched ballistic missile, the Balava, and they're currently deploying two types of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And they've got more waiting in the wings. They have development programs ongoing for three additional intercontinental ballistic missiles, including a heavy ICBM to replace the SS-18, and they're talking about reviving the idea of rail mobile ICBMs, which actually in the mid-1990s they decided really wasn't such a good idea. And the Air Force in Russia is talking about building a new bomber. They had been talking about building the PAK-DA, which they said would be a stealthy-type bomber. But it's been interesting, in the last month or so, they've talked about reviving the Blackjack production line. The Blackjack is the equivalent, or the Russian equivalent, of the American B-1. It was a bomber built 30 years ago. And the fact that they're talking about reviving that production line suggests to me that they're probably having some problem with the PAK-DA. So it looks like they're doing a lot, and they are doing a lot. But I don't think this is cause for great concern as long as two conditions apply. The first condition is that the United States and Russia continue to observe the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, which limits each side to no more than 700 deployed strategic ballistic missiles and heavy bombers, and limits each side to no more than 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. And even though there's a lot of tension between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine, both sides continue to implement the treaty, and inspections happen, data exchanges, it's all going forward relatively smoothly. And then the second condition is that the United States does what it needs to do to maintain its own strategic force, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But there are two or three things that lead me to be perhaps more relaxed about what the Russians are doing. First of all, a lot of it is simply playing catch-up. They're replacing aging systems, in many cases systems that they would have liked to have replaced 10 years ago. But there was a period really from about 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, until around 2005, 2006, when the defense budget in Moscow didn't have any money. So they basically put their modernization programs on hold. And you saw it in over the course of 1991 to 2007, 2008, in a dramatic fall in the number of Russian strategic warheads that were deployed. And that continues. So if you look at the replacement programs, even today, about half of the deployed strategic warheads on ballistic missiles are on SS-18, SS-19, and SS-25 intercontinental ballistic missiles. The 18s and 19s should have been retired 5 or 10 years ago. The SS-25 will be out of the force by 2020. So when Mr. Putin makes the announcement, well, I guess 3 weeks ago, about building 40 ICBMs, the press really got that one wrong. I mean, that was he was basically announcing the 2015 installment on a 10-year program that was approved 4 years ago, when the Russians said, we're going to build 400 strategic ballistic missiles over the course of the next 10 years. And that roughly looked appropriate in terms of replacing what they had to replace in their strategic force. A second reason why I would argue we don't need to be so concerned is there's a focus now on Russian strategic force modernization, and it doesn't look like the United States is doing much. And that's going to change, because we and the Russians are on very different modernization cycles. 10 years from now, in 2025, the Russians will be done, except perhaps a new bomber, and the United States will be deploying a new ballistic missile submarine to replace the Ohio's, probably a new intercontinental ballistic missile, a new long-range strategic bomber, and probably a new nuclear air-launched cruise missile. So the momentum is going to be very different 10 years from now. A third point is when you look at the force structures, there's also just very different design philosophies between the United States and Russia. The United States today has a single intercontinental ballistic missile and a single submarine-launched ballistic missile. And the Russians have a variety in both cases. And part of that, I think, is not just necessarily a reflection of strategic considerations. Part of it is simply bureaucratic. It's farming out work to keep the different design bureaus in Russia occupied. So they end up building more missiles than they probably logically need. And there's also a difference in how they operate the force. The Russians will build a missile, they'll keep it in the force for 15 to 20 years, it ages out, they replace it and build a new one. The U.S. military has a different approach. We basically take the missile and we extend it, we put a new engine in it, maybe a new guidance system, and we'll keep the system in the force much longer. And I'll give you an example of the single American intercontinental ballistic missile now is the Minuteman III, originally designed to carry three warheads. they've all been now downloaded to carry a single warhead. Minuteman III was first deployed in 1970. It will be retired in 2030. Now, the missiles that will retire in 2030 are going to have different engines, different guidances, a lot will be modernized, but the missile frame basically was the same. The Russian equivalent to the Minuteman III is the SS-25, a single warhead intercontinental ballistic missile. It was first deployed in 1985, and it will be out of the force by 2020. So its lifetime is going to be less than half of that of the Minuteman III. And that's, again, just the U.S. military has a different way of approaching these issues. I'd also make the observation that newer is not always better. And compared in terms of submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the Balava missile, which is now being deployed, was first tested in 2005, first deployed, I think, last year. I guess it went to sea.
2 years,
yeah. Again, the American counterpart is the Trident D5. It was first tested in 1987, deployed in 1990. You say, well, that's an old missile. Look at the test history. The Balava has been tested about 25 times. 40% of those tests have been failures, one would rather spectacularly with President Vladimir Putin watching from a neighboring ship. You look at the Trident D5, its record is now over 140 consecutive successful test flights. So there's some differences here, and I, for all of the concerns sometimes are read about Russian strategic forces, I've yet to hear a senior American military officer say, I would sure like to swap American strategic forces for Russian strategic forces. And so as long as you know, the American response should be go forward with the modernization program, I actually think budget considerations will lead us to perhaps doing less than what we would like to, or what the Pentagon now would like to do. But I think we will be able to maintain a strategic force that balances the Russians. I'm more concerned on the non-strategic nuclear weapon side because, in part, we have less visibility there. But it does look like that the Russians want to maintain a panoply of weapons, land-based, ground-based, sea-based. And it fits in with the doctrine, which sometimes is not easy to understand. They talk about de-escalation theory and the use of low-yield nuclear weapons. And so, you know, what does this suggest? And I'm not sure we have a fully clear picture on that. And then there's a particular concern with regards to non-strategic nuclear weapons, which deals with the Russian violation of the INF Treaty. The 1987 treaty banned all American and Soviet land-based missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. And last year, the U.S. government announced that the Russians have violated that treaty by testing a ground-launched cruise missile of intermediate range. And this is in the context of Russians going back to, say, 2006-2007, senior Russian officials saying, we're not sure about the efficacy of the INF Treaty because it bans just the Americans and the Russians, and we Russians worry because there are countries around us that are building intermediate range missiles. And one of those senior officials to complain about that at one time was Vladimir Putin. Now, in terms of the U.S. response, I think, one, what the administration is trying to do for now is the rightest response, which is to try to bring the Russians back into full compliance with the treaty while preparing a set of response options if the Russians don't come back into terms. In terms of actual non-strategic nuclear weapons, though, I do not see a need for the United States to match Russia either in the number of non-strategic weapons or the range. In part because NATO looks at the idea of tactical nuclear warfighting and basically says no. I mean, where do tactical nuclear weapons or non-strategic nuclear weapons fit in NATO strategy? It's basically you use it because it's a political signal to warn the other side that this conflict has reached the point where it's about to spin out of control and we don't know where it's going to go. And I would argue that in terms of what the United States already has in Europe, which are dual-capable aircraft and B-61 gravity bombs, that suffices for that mission. And the F-16s that there are due to be replaced by F-35s, and the B-61 bomb, it looks like, will be modernized. So I don't see an urgent need to match the Russians in terms of numbers or range of non-strategic nuclear weapons. And I would actually argue that the best response for dealing with this problem in Europe is for the United States and NATO to take smart steps to maintain the conventional advantages that NATO now has in Europe, both in terms of quantity, but more importantly in terms of quality of weapons. Because NATO wants to have the ability to indicate to an adversary that if necessary, you know, we're going to seek to deter you. If necessary, we can defeat you at the conventional level. And the nuclear question, let's push the issue of first use of nuclear weapons onto the Kremlin, because that's going to be a really hard decision to make. We don't want to have that decision. We want to leave that in the Russians' lap.
Thanks, Steve. That was somewhat less scary. Hans, given all the expense, why are the Russians undertaking this modernization program? Is it, do you see it as a reaction to the United States?
Well, it's partially a reaction to the general. Well, let me start by saying thank you for the invitation to come here and participate in this, of course. Having done that, it is definitely a response to, partially a response to the strategic competition, if you will, between the United States and Russia. And I'm not talking about specific weapon systems. I'm talking about national prestige. The Russians over the last 8-9 years have been very, I think, obsessed almost with this issue of parity. Not necessarily in all the details of numbers and what have you, but that what they secured, and this is one of the reasons they are still so very interested in maintaining the New START Treaty, is that it actually lends them some level of parity in the strategic realm, at least. So I think there's a general interest in maintaining Russian prestige. What that leads to remains to be seen, but I think it's harder if you have to take from what's been said in the Russian by commentators, government officials, and try to figure out if there are military thinking about what their objectives are. The point being that my task here is to talk about, you know, U.S. forces that might drive Russian concerns. And frankly speaking, it's hard to say that there is the one they're really worried about, if you will. It's more an overall strategic relationship, I think. But of course, as soon as you start talking to individual Russians about this, what is the military capability that you are mostly concerned about? I mean, there's no doubt that they're mostly concerned about very capable forces such as specifically the Trident II D5 ballistic missile. Very capable system, as Steve mentioned, very successful, very reliable, because of the fact that it can sneak up on a coast and very quickly launch a large number of weapons. Now, over here, that's not really something we entertain in our strategic thinking, but to a worst-case scenario Russian strategist, that is absolutely real. Bombers, cruise missiles sneak in, launch under the radar, so to speak. Recently, some remarks about dual-capable aircrafts in Europe, although I don't really think that is the military issue. That sounds more like an opportunistic political kind of debate they're having right now, and they're also being wrong about what they said about it, but that's another matter. But so we look at the overall force structure and what the Russians are doing with them. I think one of the most interesting developments right now is what they're doing on their ICBMs, especially the mobile ICBMs. And what we're seeing is that they're beginning to deploy them out in the field in significantly longer periods of time than they used to do just a few years ago. I don't know where it comes from or what the strategy is, but they, does it imply that they're feeling threatened and that therefore have to get better at deploy these systems into the open area? It's very hard to say. But that is an interesting, I think, development that is underway. Ironically, if you ask U.S. military people about that development and the fact that they're focusing so much on mobile systems, they're saying, good. I mean, because it's a good thing that the Russian feel secure, if they feel secure, if they can get their weapons out and hide them and don't feel vulnerable to a surprise first strike. If you look at the submarines, it's a similar interesting development. They're going to 8... possibly more, but at least for now we have seen a plan to build 8 ballistic missile submarines. But what's interesting about them is that the warhead loading capacity on the Bulava ballistic missile is significantly bigger than that on the existing 2 missiles, so that for the overall force, if you just have an 8 ballistic missile submarine force of the new Bore class versus the old Delta class, you're talking about a potential 60% increase in warheads that can be loaded on that force in the future. So what does that mean? What does that indicate? Is that just because they can do it? Or does it have a strategic meaning about, well, we now feel really vulnerable on land, so we have to put more strategic assets out to sea? You know, does it show that they're not very concerned about U.S. attack submarines capabilities? They used to be very concerned in the past, in the 1980s, about the maritime strategy going up and sinking U.S. Russian ballistic missile submarines first, if you will, or early in a crisis. Does it indicate that they have sort of confidence that they can put these submarines into a bastion or what have you? So there are some interesting developments going on in the postures, no doubt about it, but it's hard to say that this is because the Russians are really worried about this American nuclear weapon system or that one. Ironically, I think it's more the case that, in terms of what the Russians are saying, that it's U.S. non-nuclear forces that concern them. Because that spans widely. We've certainly heard a lot of that over the last 10 years, from conventional prompt global strike capabilities that they see could sort of, you know, balloon into a large capacity, but the U.S. military is not interested in having a large conventional prompt capacity. Ballistic missile defense systems that could take out enough of their strategic missiles, what have you. Precision-guided conventional cruise missiles, for example, that can go in and very accurately take out with much more capable conventional warheads than in the past, strategic systems, for example, nuclear systems as well. So they're very obsessed with this imparity, if you will, in the strategic balance or potential imparity in the strategic balance. And so for NATO and for the United States, in terms of responding to Russia, that creates, in my view, a huge dilemma, because right now in Europe, what is it or how is it that NATO has responded to Russia's aggression? Well, it is with conventional forces, of course, moving them further east, pre-positioning of equipment, larger exercises across the board. Still a very far cry from the kind of force structure deployments that were in the past. But it feeds into the Russian, I think, perception that NATO is going to increase its nuclear superiority and that they would be worse off in the future in those types of scenarios. And therefore, perhaps, is what we're seeing with them trying to maintain non-strategic nuclear forces at the level that they are, and also potentially developing a new ground-launched cruise missile. And I remember Ashton Carter, he was asked about that in Congress recently. You know, how does that ground-launched cruise missile fit into the Russian strategy or perception? And he says it seems to fit into their way of using non-strategic nuclear weapons to offset NATO conventional superiority. So that's just to say, I think it's hard to find sort of clear-cut cases where a U.S. nuclear weapon system is really spoofing the Russians these days and making them do all sorts of things, or driving the nuclear modernization. I think that is more a general overall parity national prestige issue. I think the dynamic is much more in the effect of more advanced conventional weapons.
Thanks, Hans. I'll term that medium scary. Pavel, what we just heard, I think, to a degree from both Steve and Hans, is in the sort of logic of deterrence, the Russian nuclear modernization isn't terribly scary in the sense that they can fit it into the deterrence models, and it could conceivably be an enhancing of stability in that way. You at one point in your writings on this for us mentioned that Putin and those people around him really don't understand nuclear deterrence. And I'm wondering if you see elements of that in Putin's nuclear threats and maybe even in a deeper way in some of the actual actions that he might be taking on the ground.
Certainly, there is a long tradition of nuclear deterrence, and a lot of lessons are learned sometimes through very risky situations. And we know how to construct balances. And again, we have the arms control, which still holds despite all the crisis. There were people in Russia who were really going through this school of nuclear deterrence stage after stage, but you cannot find these people in Putin's inner circle. You know, whatever you think about this combination of individuals, that one fact we know for sure, that they have no experience in the school of deterrence. And I would even say that even among the top brass, there used to be a very influential lobby which were kind of pushing forward the agenda related to, first of all, land-based strategic forces. And that lobby is practically gone through the process of military reform, one purge after another. And the new defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, really brought in many new people with combat experience. He prefers veterans and warriors to military bureaucrats. But even for this kind of top brass, the nuclear weapons are entirely foreign matter. They never really given it a thought or trained in any way to use them. That's where I think Putin's only moment when suddenly nuclear weapons were in consideration of a crisis came back in the year 99, when he just arrived to the Moscow politics, made a member of Security Council, and it was a Kosovo crisis. And Yeltsin was kind of, at the beginning at least, stating it very aggressively, you should not forget Russia is a nuclear power, we cannot be ignored. And to all intents and purposes, Russia was ignored. And all the nuclear weapons proved to be completely irrelevant in that situation. So Russia had to swallow its objections and made itself a part of the solution for Kosovo, after all, which probably, again, is part of the political baggage Putin is still carrying, that there are situations where suddenly you don't know how to put them into play. We need to invent something. We need to be creative in this regard. We need to find a way to not just to make loud statements about our missiles and capabilities, but somehow to turn them into political assets, to deploy Iskanders into Kaliningrad, then to withdraw them, to do something else in this regard. But the sober calculations, very specific calculations of risks, of measures and countermeasures, of what nuclear weapon system are capable of doing what, I think for him it is still an absolutely a matter in which he says doesn't have even a superficial knowledge and do not rely on aides and advisors who have the idea about that.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. We've heard that from both you and Hans that there is a pretty stark conventional superiority now on the U.S. side. And that in part this is what the Russians are responding to. It would follow from that, and you alluded to this a little bit, that because any conflicts are likely to, at least in the early stages, be conventional, that that the Russians might seek to compensate for that by integrating their very large tactical nuclear arsenal into their conventional warfighting doctrine plans. Do we see any signs of that? Is that something that you think about or worry about?
Well, it's a hard question to know the answer to. If you look at Russian military doctrine, at least the unclassified version, unfortunately I haven't yet had a chance to read the classified version, but basically the 2015 version and the 2010 version had identical language on when Russia would resort to nuclear weapons. And it was in two cases. One, if there were an attack with weapons of mass destruction against Russia or a Russian ally, Russia reserved the right to use nuclear weapons, or if there was an attack on Russia, not an ally, but on Russia itself, with conventional forces in which the existence of the state was at stake, then there was this reservation. Now, that's basically NATO policy from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, or 1970s and 80s, when NATO dealt with a period of conventional inferiority towards the Russians. So it's hard to get too excited about that. There's this other question, though, and it's hard to peg down. This Russian idea, it's called the de-escalation theory. And it's not clear to me how official or formal this is a part of Russian policy. I was actually at a Track 2 conversation about a month ago where five Russians who were pretty knowledgeable said de-escalation in no way is connected to formal Russian doctrine. But the idea there is that if there were a conventional conflict and Russia were to begin to lose, using a small number of low-yield nuclear weapons. And the question here is that the literature is not clear what the intent of that would be. The benign interpretation is that you use a couple of nuclear weapons basically to signal the other side, this thing's about ready to get out of control, we need to stop. Again, very similar to NATO policy and the political intent that it would be, I think, behind any consideration by NATO of use of nuclear weapons. But then there are also other explanations which seem to suggest that, you know, maybe the Russians would see some military advantage, and so that it might be integrated in a military way. Now, it's hard to get a good read on that because, you know, you go back and you look at some of the things that came out after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and in Soviet thinking, Warsaw Pact thinking, seemed to basically say, once you cross that line and use a nuclear weapon, then all bets are off, and the expectation is probably very fast escalation to very large numbers of weapons, which suggests, you know, keeping a few weapons and using them in a controlled manner may not be all that easy. But, you know, these are one of these things that I don't think we have a good fix in the unclassified world on and where the Russians are.
Well, just to make that maybe a little bit more concrete, because I think we've heard in some of our sessions that we've had here over the past several months some concern from U.S. officials about the possibility of a Baltic scenario where, and there's a few different variants of this, but one variant that I know you've heard is that there is a sort of lightning Russian strike to take whatever they want from the Baltics, and then a threat to respond with nuclear weapons if there's a counterstrike that would use Western conventional superiority. How does that scenario fit into what you just said?
No, I've been to a couple of sessions where people worry about that.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those things that if there were ever a NATO-American conventional invasion into Russia, which I don't see happening, I could in that circumstance envisage that the Russians might consider use of tactical nuclear weapons if they were to lose. But it's a very different scenario if you say the Russians take an offensive and, say, seize half of Estonia and then tell NATO, if you attack or counterattack with conventional forces, we will escalate to the nuclear level. That's a pretty big bet because while you might think it would be very implausible, and I it's hard for me to conceive of circumstances in which an American president would use nuclear weapons if there had not been use of nuclear weapons against the United States or against an American ally. If you had the use of Russian nuclear weapons to defend ill-gotten gains in a NATO territory, I think an American nuclear response would actually be quite plausible. So it's something I think people ought to think about, but I'm not sure it's a plausible scenario. It's a really risky bet for the Russians to be banking. And that's why I would argue that the correct response to dealing with what the Russians are doing in terms of their modernization effort, both at the tactical nuclear level and at the conventional level in the European area, is not try to match them with non-strategic nuclear weapons, is maintain NATO conventional advantages. Because, again, if somebody's going to have to make that decision to first use nuclear weapons, let's have the Russians make that decision, because it's going to be a really hard one.
Okay. Not sure how great I feel about them making the decision either, but I see your point. Hans, Steve just sort of emphasized the importance of U.S. Western conventional forces in this balance, and you very much emphasize that seems to be what the Russians are responding to. Do the Russians have a point here? I mean, are U.S. conventional forces actually reaching a level of sophistication where they threaten the Russian deterrent? And I'm referring not just to the cruise missiles, but also the case that the Russians make so often that the ballistic missile defenses threaten their deterrent?
Well, I certainly don't think on the strategic level, if you will, as sort of a non-nuclear decapitating capability against the Russian nuclear forces. Absolutely not. But I think it's what when the Russians get into this conversation, it seems to me that it has more to do with sort of smaller scenarios where something could happen and suddenly over here we cannot hold the line or whatever the situation might be. I mean, there's obviously no doubt that a ballistic missile defense system deployed in Europe cannot threaten the Russian ballistic missile force. It's just way beyond its capacity. But Russian strategists might think that, well, gee, if we had a very limited scenario in which we had to use something, maybe not against the United States, but somewhere else, that there might be an effect. I mean, here as well as there, you can very quickly design scenarios, worst-case scenarios, that pretty much puts you in any conclusion you want to reach. And I think what's been frightening to see in this East-West crisis here is that how quickly people on both sides, pundits and former officials and what have you, how quickly they have sort of caught on to it and come up with these scary scenarios and been willing to escalate. That phenomenon, frankly, is one of the most worrisome aspects of this, that it is possible to go so far so fast. So that should remind us something about crisis stability issues as well. But on the conventional, I don't, you know, when people ask, I mean, there was a case here just a few weeks ago or months ago where, you know, in response to the Russian INF violation claimed by the U.S. State Department report, that the Pentagon came out with a response, I think, to Congress saying, we're now looking at options, you know, and they range from, you know, counter-force options to sort of, you know, countervailing options to, you know, in-kind options, you know, a very long list of potential options that you could look at. And so very quickly, that turned into, in the news media that the United States is considering deploying, ground-launched cruise missiles in Europe again. And I remember, you know, getting a barrage of calls from Eastern European news media and Russian news media. Is this really true? Is this really true? And, of course, it's not true. I mean, you knock on the door on every U.S. military planner, and that's the last thing they want to do. They see no need for that type of a response, even if Russia deploys a nuclear ground-launched cruise missile in Europe. And it's very simple. Why not? Because, first of all, you didn't want to get into this political battle in Europe again about where is this thing going to go, you know, and public opposition to deployment of nuclear weapons, we remember it. But it's a hot potato politically. But also militarily, I don't think they need it. And so the United States already have plenty of air-launched nuclear cruise missile and conventional capabilities that can be brought to bear in such a situation. And you can very quickly move your bombers in. You don't have to have an army unit deployed over there. It costs a lot of money. We still have Tomahawks on the submarines with a very long range. The Air Force is developing several thousand JASSM cruise missiles, conventional cruise missiles, of which a good portion will be extended range with over 1,100-kilometer range. Those are the kind of thing I think Russians worry about when they think limited scenarios around the border and where they can get pushed back or pushed in, depending on who they are.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So do you think that on the Western side that we need or that we have a mechanism for understanding and for integrating the strategic stability aspects of conventional systems into our planning?
I'm not sure how far we've gone on it. The latest nuclear guidance from the Obama administration, released in 2013, is on several levels specific about a requirement that U.S. planners, planning strategic and regional plans, should rely more on advanced conventional weapons, and that nuclear weapons sort of can be moved more into the background, not in the overall mission, so to speak, or the core mission, but that in scenarios, contingencies, they need to rely more on conventional weapons if they can. And so I think that that's not a new development, but it's interesting to see it so clearly in the guidance. I mean, basically, that has been a trend ever since the end of the Cold War. And we've gradually see more advanced conventional weapons moving closer up into the strategic effects package of U.S. military capabilities. So I think that's a development that's in full swing, and it's not going to stop. It is at the core of what the United States military wants to do on a global scale, not just with Russia, but everywhere. So I think that is going to continue to drive and be an irritant in the eyes of those in the Russian military planning community that want to be irritated about it.
Of which there are plenty, I'm sure. Okay, well, why don't we go to the audience, and we'll take, I think, a couple of questions at a time. And so please catch my eye, and when there should be a microphone going around, and when the microphone gets to you, please identify yourself and be sure to actually ask a question. This gentleman right here.
Thank you. Anthony Odie, formerly with the World Bank. As an outsider to this field, I was meant to be, in the other meeting over there. What most surprised me was the statements about the West enjoying an advantage on the conventional side. And, my ears prick up because I'm hearing about European countries, including, I'm afraid, my own, having trouble meeting the 2% defense spending target. If I understand you correctly, you are not talking about chaps in tanks. You are talking about clever ways of offsetting chaps in tanks, including missiles and so on, that can offset them. Am I getting that right?
Who wants to address that?
I'll take the first question. Yeah. I think in large part because not only on the nuclear side, but on the conventional side, there was this 15-year period from 91 to 2005 where the Russian army didn't get much of anything. And so NATO and the United States have very significant qualitative advantages, but also still have in the European area conventional numerical advantages. Now, the Russians have a very active conventional modernization program ongoing, and if NATO doesn't think about things in 3 or 4 years, it may see some of its advantages erode. So it has to pay a little bit more attention to this question, I think, now, given the sort of behavior you've seen in Russia over the last 18 months with regards to Ukraine, and a readiness at least there to use force. So it's an advantage. It's one that the Russians would like to erode. My guess is the Russians will have more luck in terms of coming to something of parity in terms of numbers, but I think it's going to be a difficult or more difficult issue for the Russians to come up and catch up with the United States and with NATO in terms of the quality of some of the precision-guided weapons that that Hans was referring to.
But there's two other aspects to his chaps and tanks question. The first is the chaps, yeah, by which he means, I think, Europeans. And we've been a little bit, or a certain kind of European, we've been a little bit vague when we say this, when we've been tending to say Western. Are we saying that this is really, in the context of all the defense cuts we've seen in Europe recently, really an American capability, and the Europeans are just sort of along for the ride? And the second aspect is the tanks, which is that we're not really talking about the sort of traditional armored formations. We're talking about advanced conventional weapons that tend to be controlled from trailers in Nevada and fly at remote distances. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's a mix of both. My guess is that behind closed doors, when he was in Brussels for the defense ministers meeting, that Secretary Carter made a big pitch to say to the Europeans, you have to up your defense spending too on the conventional side. that if we're going to preserve the advantages that NATO has in the conventional area, it can't just be the United States. And certainly there will be, the response will be a mix of some very advanced systems, but also that you saw when Secretary Carter was in Brussels, it's going to be some of the old system tanks. I mean, where the big news that came out of the meeting was that the United States had sent to Europe an armored brigade. And this was the first time in a year and a half that you actually had American tanks in Europe, with the exception of a small number for training purposes at a training ground in Germany. And those tanks, that brigade did exercises in the Baltic region in Poland for about 3 months. And when they wrapped up, the troops came home, but the tanks, the infantry fighting vehicles, the heavy artillery, and the 1,000 other associated vehicles are staying behind. They're going to be pre-positioned in Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and the Baltic states. So there is a certain aspect of beginning to deploy some of the traditional aspects of conventional military power, but also putting them in the eastern part of NATO, both to send a signal to Moscow, but also to be reassuring to those governments.
How would you like to comment on this?
Yes, I think it's a good question about chaps and tanks. And I think it also reflects on the larger question, is it a new Cold War? Are we facing the same sort of situation? And one significant difference is that I do remember that old Cold War when in Eastern Germany alone it was 500,000 Soviet troops deployed. That was a lot of chaps and tanks. And now you hear on the borders of Ukraine, Russia is amassing 50,000 troops. It is an order of magnitude lower. Even in Russia, you see kind of a lot less of a possibility to deploy chaps and tanks. And there is no second echelon for that matter. But besides chaps and tanks, and what Russia is very worried about, there are now drones. And that's a weapon system against which Russia has no countermeasure, no ability to balance, and is very worried about. Because they're cheap, they can be produced in large numbers, and Russia doesn't know how to counter that. Long-range strike drones. In principle, technology is not that complicated, but Russia is arguing, in essence, it's the same weapon system as a land-based cruise missile. And there is a point into that argument. It's impossible to make the point stick on legal ground, but that's suddenly another dimension of the whole war, where Russia feels exposed, vulnerable, unable to balance and to deploy anything which would resemble that capability.
Well, just in addition to that, there's no doubt that for the foreseeable future, the United States is going to enjoy an overwhelming conventional capability and capacity, not just in military force, but also in R&D and further development. I think even if all the NATO countries paid 2%, it's not going to change that fact. I mean, I think that issue is more about what it's prudent to do, or, you know, everybody should, you know, pay their share or whatever the decision is at any given time. But I think one of the things that characterized NATO's defense spending over the last, decade is that it has actually spent a lot of its money that was intended for R&D improvements and maintenance on the war in Afghanistan, sustaining the forces that were sent over there, flying it, whatever. So suddenly you have a problem that you have sort of hollowed out that chest, so to speak, by not doing that while you were over there. And so I think that's another issue. What we've seen with Russia is that what really seems to make NATO planners nervous right now is this sort of trend that Russia is building. The capacity seems to be building a capacity to move large number of troops, relatively quickly back and forth along the border. One month they'll be down off, Ukraine. The next minute they'll go up north for an exercise, et cetera. You know, tens of thousands of troops, to amass them quickly. And so, but that's not modern warfare. That's just like moving a lot of troops, you know. It doesn't really say anything about what can they do in a modern battlefield. And so one of the things that the U.S., for example, is working on, you mentioned drones, is that instead of drones flying in and taking out that Toyota with the terrorist or, you know, something like that, we're now beginning to plan for mass drone attacks where mm-hmm. drones work together in a large formation going in. It's not gotten very far, but we're talking about development of software and capabilities in the range of 20 to 50 drones going in at the same time, that type of stuff. So that's underway now, and I can tell you the Russians will be worried about that, absolutely. But even though the Russians have a modernization program underway, think about the different components. Ballistic missile submarines, ICBMs, bombers, tactical fighter aircraft, SU-34, Iskander missile deployment integration into the systems, new attack submarines, the Caliber sea launch cruise missile, conventional force developments, including replacing, it seems, over the next decade, the entire armored tank inventory, armored vehicle inventory, command and control systems with a new focus on border security, et cetera, et cetera. This is an enormous project that I frankly do not believe they can lift, okay? And there's something about, I think, the Russian way of talking about these things that if you listen to what they're saying, it's always about, well, next year it'll be 100% bigger. You know, we'll have double the number of missiles. It's always this kind of, you know, chest-thumping type of way of talking about it. You know, the proof is in the pudding. We'll see what comes out later on. But I think if you hear the U.S. intelligence community, they're still saying that even with the current modernization program, in a decade, the Russian military forces will still be overwhelmingly dominated by Soviet era equipment.
I just had to ask one of the pieces that is, you know, who's manning the equipment? And, well, I think we've seen in the last 18 months that, certainly in Crimea, special forces, airborne, are very good. They've put a lot of attention to those forces, and that traditionally those were the forces that got the best equipment, the most training money. But if you then go to the regular Russian army, as I understand, probably half of the enlisted personnel are still conscripts, and the conscription tour now in Russia is 1 year. Yeah, so you really have to, in terms of the quality of the people, to sort of operate in what would be a hopefully an environment that they never have to face and we never have to face, but not with a lot of training and experience.
Okay, up here in the second row on the left.
Hi, hello. My name is Maciej Lemke. I'm currently a Georgetown University graduate student, and I'm with NTI. Nuclear Threat Initiative, and my question is more about disarmament process. And, well, we've experienced, you know, the most recent review conference, which wasn't really satisfying. And in that respect, how do you see this Russian rhetoric impacting further disarmament process and, you know, towards the next review conference, because people are very much afraid that we're going to fail again, the international community will fail again at another REFCON. And how do you see that playing out?
Why don't we take one more question across the aisle there, and then
Hi, Mohammed Omar. I'm also a grad student currently at FAS. My question is, and kind of touched on this, that Russia is spending a lot of money. Is that sustainable? And how are they getting the resources? Thank you.
I think we know the answer to that second question. Who wants to take that? Those questions.
Well, we'd love to talk about the first aspect of it. There are two issues to it, I think. There's one about sort of the prospect of the impact on force numbers, if you will. And there's another element of it that has to do with the impact of the current crisis on the future development of nuclear forces. If you look at the first part of it, the prospect for further reductions, then I think there's no indication that the United States or Russia will start to increase the number of nuclear weapons. Even with the current modernization programs, the trend is south. And so that will continue. even though Congress here doesn't like the word unilateral reductions, unilateral reductions of the stockpile are embedded in, it is implicit in the modernization program the U.S. is now embarking on. So it'll happen. Russia, even with its modernization program on ballistic missiles and submarines, they will have fewer of them in the future in terms of overall force level. They're not going to go over the New START treaty. The one area where I can see that there could be potential level, but in a way that's a good thing, is in the number of how many warheads could you put on ballistic missiles. In the future, you could potentially get into a situation, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but you could get into a situation where suddenly, because you build systems that are more heavily MIRVed, the overall force, or like the submarines that can carry more warheads, that you would have to take some of them off and not have full load in order to stay in compliance with the treaty. But the U.S. is already deep in that kind of a posture. Russia, not so much. But who knows? In the future, it might want to move in that direction where it has fewer weapons deployed and more in reserve, if you will. On the other aspect, I think the issue of the impact on force development is another challenge for the non-proliferation regime. And the reason I say this is because we're now seeing Russia finishing or getting into the final round of its strategic modernization. And we see the United States moving into its round of strategic modernization. And one issue that the NPT community as a regime has to, struggle with is, well, if all the nuclear weapon states continue to modernize in perpetuity and talk about having nuclear weapons for the major part of this century, does that, or to what extent does that, challenge the obligations under Article 6 of the treaty of moving through negotiations toward eventual elimination? I think that issue is challenged on many levels, but it could, the East-West crisis and certainly also what's happening in the South China Sea could make it easier for people to argue that you cannot reduce too much or fundamentally change nuclear force structures. But again, I think the overall numbers are going south, but I think it's more on force structure that there is a continuing drift.
Do you worry about that having an impact on third country nuclear forces, either ones that exist or countries that don't currently have nuclear forces?
Well, so I see that all the nuclear weapon states are looking at each other and seeing what they're doing. I mean, it's not just a parity issue. It's also getting ideas. I mean, we're seeing a new interesting development happening with China that has just apparently finally decided to put some MIRVed warheads on its silo-based ballistic missiles. Not that the warheads are there in peacetime, I'm saying, but the capability. And we're seeing moves in India that is shifting its strategic force planning more towards China than Pakistan as it has been in the past. And their defense planning community also beginning to entertain the thoughts of developing MIRV capabilities. Indian government has not made such a decision, at least to my knowledge, but I'm just saying I think all nuclear weapon states look to each other, for what it is that you need to have to be safe and secure. But it's still very striking, I think, that when you look at all the nuclear weapon states, there's no other nuclear weapon state on the planet than Russia and the United States that believe you need more than a maximum of a couple of hundred nuclear weapons for security. So I think it speaks to how overwhelmingly the United States and Russian nuclear strategic thinking is still embedded in the Cold War.
Pavel, so do they have the money for this? Where are they going to get it?
The very short answer is no. It's not sustainable. It is very seriously unsustainable. And the proof positive of that is that the rearmament program approved was supposed to last for 10 years, 10 to 20, but in fact, there should be another one from the year 15 to 25, and they cannot design that. So there is no current plan how to cut, where to economize, and the political leadership, in essence, remains in denial of the fact of the economic crisis, which doesn't help at all. They cannot put together a meaningful state budget for a year so they don't really know how to deal with all this grandiose plan designed. The fact of the matter is they will have very soon to make decisions about what to cut, where to economize. And my feeling is that the priority on strategic modernization will continue at the expense of some other programs, but maybe in the Navy, maybe in the Air Force. And if that priority is sustained, the more there is a political pressure of finding a way to put that into play. We are kind of cutting everything else, we're investing in that. What is the use of it?
Okay. A couple of questions here in the front row.
I'm Eugenia Osgood, and I spent several years working on theater and strategic nuclear weapons of the Soviet Union. And
be careful to speak into the microphone. So people can
hear. Well, the big problem, as far as I can see, or what everybody believes, is the strategic, rather theater. The theater balance in Europe. Something similar happened in the early 1980s, and that's when Alexei Arbatov, who is an outstanding arms controller, first, of course, Soviet, now he is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he has written an extraordinary article, which I recommend to everybody, about the deterioration and the death, basically, the end of arms control. He views the current...
Can we get to the question in this, though, please?
The dangerous, this is the most dangerous part of the 21st century so far, because there is no longer the bipolarity of the Cold War, but there is a very,
please,
very...
Please move to a question.
A very dangerous situation where... The remarks that are being made by all the Soviet government representatives, including President Putin, show that they simply don't know enough about what a nuclear war in Europe could do. And that is the great danger.
Okay, thank you.
Charles Osgood, a retired federal employee. One thing that was never discussed in the nuclear part is the weapons themselves. It's all been delivery. Apparently, we are engaged or will be engaged, when I read in the newspapers, in checking over and making sure the darn things work. And since the test ban treaty, it's been done with computers. And along the way, apparently, they discovered ways to make them better and actually work, maybe. So, well, that's one thing about the test ban treaty. And so the question, I guess, is are the Russians doing the same thing, and to what effect are they possibly worried about our weapons actually working a higher percentage than they might have before?
Why don't we take one more question in the second row here before we come back?
Thank you. Diane Perlman, George Mason School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. Anyway, as long as I'm following a Charles Osgood, there was another Charles Osgood who had a strategy of GRIT, graduated reciprocated initiatives and tension reduction. And everything that you're talking about is very provocative and escalatory. And you talk a lot about sending signals to one side, and it very often happens that the other side receives a different message than the one that you think that you're sending, and it provokes escalation. So my question is, and also deterrence, Ralph K. White said deterrence works if it's accompanied by drastic tension reduction. So what about other, like, second order change strategies like mediation, tension reduction? Nothing deals, it's all dealing with a symptom and not the underlying conflict. And, you know, so what about mediation, conflict transformation, creative strategies of conflict transformation, because there's no end game to any of this.
Who wants to attack those questions, Paul?
It is it is a difficult subject matter. And on the weapons, certainly no testing and weapons are not getting any younger. And a computer simulation can tell you only that much. And in principle, in Russia, they're not very good at computer simulation. You know, the best hope they have is that many weapon systems in the Soviet Union tradition were built to last. And, you know, it goes for every weapon system, including the nuclear warheads. But in this particular aspect, very pragmatically, testing makes sense. You want to be sure that your old weapons are still functional, that they can perform. So whatever are other considerations, from that particular angle, yes, you, in principle, if you are maintaining nuclear arsenal, you need a test. And that certainly goes very much against the NPT regime, and certainly it will be very difficult to have another conference, even with that level of success, if you are returning to testing. And at least in this respect, Russia is so far trying to play responsibly. But as for the question about possibility of finding a way around this very linear confrontational situation we are facing, typically it's not about the channels as such, it's about the political will, about ability to listen, about ability to attempt to comprehend what is going on, and not just to be obsessed with your own fears and with the very limited circle of trusted aides. After that, you trust nobody. And that situation is not really very conducive to opening second channels, to experiment with attempts to build trust and so on.
So, Steve, I wonder if you take up those questions too, but also following on what Pavel said, given that there are both political and actually stockpile incentives for Russians to think about testing, should the U.S. be thinking about sharing some of their testing technology with the Russians?
Yeah. Well, this will be a point where I think I disagree with Pavel.
So hard to do.
Yeah. Now, first of all, I think the technologies, the United States has what's called the Stockpiled Stewardship Program, which thus far the directors of the national laboratories and the head of strategic command at the end of each year say to the president, sir, with this program, we are confident in the reliability of the weapons without having to resort to nuclear testing. My guess is that actually sharing those kinds of techniques and computer programs with the Russians would be hard, not just because they're very sophisticated, but also it might reveal lots of things about how we put our nuclear weapons together that we probably wouldn't want to share with the Russians and vice versa. But I guess where I would disagree with Pavel is I actually think if you don't have testing and then you have maybe less than 100% confidence in your nuclear weapons working, that may not be a bad thing, because this gets back into the bizarre, right. Cold War era. If you're contemplating a first strike against the other guy, you need to be sure all of your nuclear weapons are going to work. And if you have a question mark saying maybe some of them don't work, that's a disincentive for a first strike. On the other hand, if you're talking about retaliation, I don't have to have all of my weapons work, just some of the weapons work. So I actually think there's having a little bit of uncertainty there is not a bad thing for purposes of strategic stability. The question about the end of arms control, I personally wish that we could have moved beyond the New START treaty. I think there was actually proposals from the Obama administration fairly early on to go beyond New START, both in terms of reducing deployed strategic weapons, but also getting into the questions of reserve strategic weapons and non-strategic weapons. In fact, there was a proposal out there that had the Russians said yes for the first time ever, you would have had U.S. and Russian negotiators talking about all of the nuclear weapons in the arsenal. Because what the New START Treaty covers is it covers deployed strategic weapons. It covers perhaps 35-40% of the total U.S. arsenal and probably a similar proportion on the Russian side. In the current environment, first of all, the last several years, the Russians have not been prepared to move beyond the New START Treaty. In the current environment, in the next couple of years, it's hard to see that changing. But the optimist, and I try to always find an optimistic note in me, says it may change around 2018, 2019. Because at that point, you're 2 years out from the expiration of the New START Treaty, which has a 10-year term. And it does seem to me that the Russians, as did the Soviets, always liked to have some kind of a strategic arms control agreement in place, because that was valuable in two ways in terms of capping American strategic capabilities. And that's going to be more important in the early 2020s when we're beginning to crank up our modernization program, but also in terms of providing a degree of transparency and information and such. So my guess is the arms control process between Washington and Moscow may not make much progress in the next couple of years, but I think around 2018, 2019, the sides may come back to it. And then hopefully they can do more than just extend the New START treaty, but actually begin to grapple with some of these other questions and bring the weapons numbers down.
So that's our plea for long-term funding for the arms control initiative. Hans, did you want to come in on that?
On this issue of warhead, building on what Steve said here, and also Powell to some extent, in my understanding, the fundamental difference with the U.S. approach with nuclear warhead maintenance after the end of the Cold War and ending reliance on nuclear testing has been the stockpile stewardship program and just relying on refabricating, furbishing, but also modernizing, but working with the same warhead types, basically, and extending them. The Russian approach is different because they don't have a stockpile stewardship program in the way we know it. So they tend to reproduce warheads when they age out instead. The United States just has a program now that is more than halfway through production of something in the order of 1,200 warheads, the W-76 warhead for the Navy's ballistic missile submarine, to extend the life of that weapon system for another 30-plus years. Right after that comes the B-61. Oh, we're building a new guided version of the B-61 gravity bomb. And after that come other warheads for the ballistic missiles. But none of them envision resorting to nuclear testing. But it does resort to sort of other forms of testing, not nuclear explosion, but there's plenty of testing. It is hydrodynamic testing. It's simulated testing. You name it. So it's a very expansive program, and the Russians just don't have that, so their approach is very different. On the death of arms control, absolutely. I don't think there's a death of arms control. I think arms control comes up when there's an urgent need for the countries to do it, and I think there always is, to some extent, between the United States and Russia. That's been our tradition. Putin has already said that once we get to the end of the New START treaty, he will be willing to think about this. God knows what the situation is at that time. But even if things go worse, I think there is a real incentive for even national strategic security interest to try to cap what another country can do. So that is a really powerful motivator, I think, in continuing nuclear arms control.
Okay. Why don't we come up here to Jonas in the third row, and then we'll go to the back. Right there.
Thank you. It's been a really interesting discussion so far. I was going to ask, mostly directed to Steve, on sort of the distinction you just touched upon between strategic and non-strategic weapons. First of all, if this distinction sort of still makes sense, it's very much a sort of Cold War relic, and combined a little bit with some of the scenarios that you talked about as well, where we could see in Russia the sort of escalation type of scenario where tactical nuclear weapons could play a component. So my first would be whether it sort of makes sense in this, that all use of nuclear weapons is strategic, that you will trigger a nuclear war, or whether you could see scenarios and combined with what you talked about, are there a military doctrine?
Hold on just a second, Steve. Were there some questions in the back of the room? Yeah, so, why don't we take two questions way back there? I can't really see those people. No.
Hello, yeah. I'm Jeff Price with Johns Hopkins Sites Foreign Policy Institute. Could you say a little more about submarine-launched cruise missiles?
Ours or theirs?
Always a fun topic. U.S. or Russian?
Russian. Particularly attack subs.
Okay, I think there's one more question toward the back there.
Ann Sisk, U.S. Air Force. In the past couple of years, there were a couple of news items that there was a lot of changes that needed to be made in our nuclear force, especially with our ICBM crews. Wondering if you could speak on sort of the Russian perception of that or reaction to it.
Okay, Steve, you want to start with the question to you?
I'll start with the strategic, non-strategic. I mean, it's one of these things that we use in the arms control world that's probably becoming a bit outdated. My own personal view is if a nuclear weapon goes off anywhere near me, it's strategic. But I would argue it's time to move past it, and you're beginning to see some of these lines blur. So Hans mentioned the modernization of the B-61 bomb. You know, right now there are four variants of the B-61, one of which is considered strategic, three which are considered tactical. At the end of this modernization program, there will be one variant of the B-61. If that is deployed with the U.S. Air Force in Europe, it'll be tactical. And if it's deployed at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri for the B-2, it'll be strategic, and it's the same weapon. So I would actually argue arms control now ought to move to a place where you treat a nuclear weapon as a nuclear weapon as a nuclear weapon. And so in my ideal arms control world, the next approach would have a U.S.-Russian negotiation where you'd limit X, my number would be somewhere around 2,500 nuclear weapons on both sides, and that counts everything that's a nuclear weapon. And then you might have a sublimit in that that would limit deployed strategic weapons, because deployed weapons that are on missiles, on submarines, or on intercontinental ballistic missiles, those are the most readily usable. So you might want to constrain those in a special way. But it would make sense for the next round of negotiations to begin to address all weapons. It's something the Russians resist, but the Russians actually, they contradict themselves on this one, because at the same time that they say, well, we want to hold off and not address non-strategic nuclear weapons, they also say it's now time to bring everybody else in. If you look at what everybody else has, Britain is the only country in the world that has weapons that would be categorized only as strategic under the new START treaty. Everybody else has stuff that would be categorized as non-strategic. So if the Russians really want to get to a point where you bring in the third countries, you're not going to get there unless you begin to talk about American and Russian non-strategic weapons. And the simplest way to do that would be a limit that covers all nuclear weapons, regardless of deployed, non-deployed, strategic, non-strategic, with maybe a sublimit on deployed strategic systems.
Hans, do you want to take some of those?
Yeah, there's an interesting, in the debate about tactical nuclear weapons, you'll quite often hear this comparison that the Russians have a 10-to-1 advantage. And it's very interesting because, you know, so to some people, that is a significant thing. But I think to the U.S. military, it's like, so what? I mean, I don't really think that is an issue for them, because they don't see a military need for that categorization anymore. And in fact, I think the U.S. military very early on moved out of that kind of thinking. Even back in the late 1980s, starting to unilaterally withdraw tactical weapons from the Navy, throughout the 90s, you know, wiped out the Army weapons very quickly. Clinton denuclearized the surface fleet. Obama administration, even though he was beaten up by Congress over threatening to reduce nuclear forces so unilaterally, one of his first acts was unilaterally withdraw and retire the sea-launched Tomahawk cruise missile nuclear capability. So I think the U.S. has just fundamentally moved out of that way of thinking, and now they're thinking more about, to the extent it is about nuclear, that, like Steve says, all nuclear is strategic, but you can use the strategic nuclear in lesser or greater scenarios in different ways. And so they think more about, you know, turning up and down the heat, so to speak, in different ways than it's about a particular group of weapons that has to serve a certain, you know, tactical battlefield function. But it's interesting also if you look at the Russian tactical nuclear weapons inventory. I frankly think that a lot of what's there is there because it was left over. That you have air delivered, you have air defense, you have anti-ballistic missile defense, you have some Army ballistic missiles, and a lot of Navy weapons still left. And so they see a need for this across the field of scenarios, apparently. Or maybe it's just the military services that don't want to give them up. I mean, it's very hard to read exactly why they live on. But I think there's a trend in the Russian military that even what is left of this, the non-strategic nuclear forces are reducing, even without an arms control treaty, simply because of it. A lot is it's old crap. I mean, excuse my French, but I think that is a lot of old systems that need to go. We're seeing signs that some of their attack submarines are losing capability in the future. Some of their surface ships are losing capability in the future, simply because they're shifting to modern conventional systems that can be used for what nuclear cruise missiles were used for in the past. So I think that's a, that's an important development that's happening. On their Russian submarine cruise missiles, sea-launched cruise missiles, there was a question about that. Well, so they have a whole host of them, if you will, a handful of them, that were designed to shoot aircraft carriers, surface battle groups, or be used as land attack missiles. And some of those are being phased out. Some are living on for a little while longer until they will be phased out. Others see a continuing mission, for example, land attack cruise missile, I think will have more of a future mission still. There are rumors that they're developing a new nuclear cruise missile called the Caliber, which also exists in a conventional format, or several different conventional formats, by the way. And they still have a leftover from the Cold War, the SSN-21. The new attack submarine, the Yasin, the new attack submarine, has been equipped with a nuclear capability. And so that force type of force structure will continue in the future. Air defense systems are becoming more advanced. Frankly speaking, possible in the future that they would not need a nuclear capability for air defense systems anymore. Ballistic missile defense systems, well, I mean, they have one of the two systems that are still operational, apparently still with a nuclear warhead. That system is being upgraded, but it's a local system around Moscow, so they're going to get it if they use it. And so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of an odd way of planning, if you will. So the only way we can really compare tactical nuclear weapons, I think, between our kind of posture and the Russian posture is in the air-delivered weapons, because that's the only where, that's the only place we both have some kind of nuclear, you know, non-strategic capability, if you will. What was the other issue? Glitches? There was the question about ICBM glitches, how the Russians view that. I really don't know. You can probably speak better to that.
I haven't heard anything about that. I'm very sorry of not being able to provide a specific answer. On the submarines, I probably may add that it is, for some reasons, exactly in that class of submarines that Russia, Soviet Union and Russia had very bad luck with the subs. Both Komsomolets lost in sea, and Kursk lost at sea, were submarines of that class. And the new generation, Yasin class, supposed to be going on much faster than it does. It's only one submarine which now is undergoing trial, and it's undergoing them for a while already. Something isn't quite right with that submarine, with Severodvinsk, and they're not really saying much about that. Unlike with Bulava, where more or less information you cannot hide there, you can at least keep it quiet, but something isn't obviously working well with that program. And on non-strategic weapons, I think it's still striking that having so many of them in the Russian military, not training to use them. There is very little of field manuals about what to do with them. A lot is being said and demonstrated and kind of trained and exercised with strategic, with non-strategic, with technical new weapons. There is a lot of them, and nothing is really happening with them. You don't see in any way, you know, many things you cannot hide, except for kind of in their storages. But troops are really not training for this environment at all.
So we're just about out of time, but I want to ask the panelists sort of to in one last question, maybe they could each take about 30 seconds on, and it's a simple question, really. Given that we started with Putin's nuclear threats, and the sort of tenor of the conversation has been that that isn't, as Pavel just said, reflected in the reality on the ground, that there is a certain amount of strategic stability in the Russian and U.S. arsenals, which isn't being dramatically eroded, what should we do in response to Putin's nuclear threats? And I suppose the answer can be nothing, but I'd be interested if there's another answer. Why don't we start at the end, and Hans?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing, but I should certainly say, please don't overreact. I mean, I think we've had over the last year and two a fair amount of overreaction to this. And it's been said by others, but I do think that beyond everything else, I think the Russian, the issue with the Russian menace, if you will, these days is not a nuclear one. It's all that sort of little green men, border activity type of stuff, and very low tier types of conflict challenges. That's where the challenge is. So we have to be careful, not because we hear some official statements that said, well, we would consider using nuclear weapons, and therefore say, aha, that means that they're lowering the threshold. So I think it's very important not to overreact. But it's also important to react to some extent, but I think it's more about challenging the wisdom of using nuclear language so loosely. That is the problem, and especially if that style reflects that the current generation of Russian military planners and policy strategists just don't know very much about it from the past, or haven't spent a whole lot of time on it, or what the situation is. So I think, trying to have conversations with the Russians about what the implications of potential use of nuclear weapons is might go a pretty long way.
Conversations?
I would second both those points. We ought not to be overreacting to what we see, because the actual programs are far less threatening than the rhetoric would suggest. But it would be appropriate to call Putin out on this kind of irresponsible talk. I mean, look at what Barack Obama has said over the last 8 years. Every time he talks about nuclear weapons, it's about reductions, it's about reducing their role in American security policy. At one point it was about even their elimination. And there ought to be a certain amount of pushback rhetorically against the Russian president when he uses language that suggests he has a very loose understanding of these weapons and their potential effects.
Pavel?
I agree, and I think it is also possible to find allies with that in the rather unexpected camp. There are very strong anti-nuclear sentiments in Europe, in Germany in particular. And it's one thing when Putin is called from the official quarters, but I think to mobilize that sentiment is also a very important resource for foreign policy, that nobody is going to respond in kind, but there is a lot of opposition to the rhetoric, to the activities, to potential nuclear testing in this sense, and it's really a broad coalition. It's not only strategic planners, it's also grassroots.
Okay, well, I don't think it would be possible for you to overreact in thanking the panel for excellent presentations, so please join me in doing that.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.